It's hard to remember now, but the internet used to be fun.
I can't believe how easy it is to surf the net.
Surf's up.
On Long Shadow, Breaking the Internet, we'll trace how a tool that once fueled democracy...
Opposition activists organized the march on Facebook.
...became a weapon aimed at the very heart of it.
You're watching the unraveling of our democracy right now.
From Longlead and PRX, this is Long Shadow, Breaking the Internet. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Right now in the Netherlands, there's a whole dairy farm floating on a barge.
To get the permits for this, we needed to prove that the cows would not get seasick.
It is not a gimmick, though. The barge could be a model for farmers adapting to climate change. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, keeping livestock and livelihoods afloat. Also, a former president of Colombia, whose legacy is hotly debated, has been convicted of a crime.
This conviction is a huge deal because it's the first time that a former president is charged with anything.
Plus, why experts worry that a ceasefire between Thailand and Cambodia may not hold.
And reaching mindfulness through immersion in a forest, Shinto style.
I'm going to invite you to walk in silence.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us this Tuesday. We start today in Colombia, where Álvaro Uribe has just become the country's first former president to be convicted of a crime. In this case, witness tampering and bribery.
It's a divisive verdict, but then Uribe was a divisive president. Some Colombians saw him as a national hero who walked the country back from the brink of economic collapse. But he is more widely remembered as a ruthless strongman who undermined Colombian democracy and enabled human rights violations.
Sergio Guzman is director of Colombia Risk Analysis. He's based in Bogota. We spoke today about the significance of this verdict.
According to witness testimony and evidence presented in the court, the former paramilitaries were suggesting that Uribe and his family were allegedly implicated with the formation of paramilitary groups back in the 1990s and 1980s. And Uribe had been trying to get many of these witnesses to change their testimony to make him look better or not make him look guilty in this case.
Stunning charges against a former president who was actually in charge of pacifying the paramilitaries, now found guilty. I mean, it should be pretty obvious, but why is this conviction seen as such a big deal in Colombia?
This conviction is a huge deal because it's the first time that a former president is charged with anything under criminal judicial proceedings. And Uribe continues to be a very important element on Colombian right-wing politics. Uribe's legacy is hotly debated between people in the right, the center, and the left, and he still holds a very significant influence over one of the main opposition parties called the Centro Democrático Party.
Tell us more, Sergio, about Uribe's role in Colombia's politics over the years and what has made him such a divisive figure in the country.
Uribe has had an outsized role in Colombian politics since 2002, when he was first elected on a mandate to more have a heavy-handed approach against the insurgent groups of Colombia. He then was hugely popular, changed the constitution once to be able to afford re-election immediately, then wanted to change the constitution for a second time to get re-election, and he was not allowed to do that. But he anointed a successor whose name is Juan Manuel Santos, later became president of Colombia. But Santos was negotiating with the former FARC guerrilla group, a peace deal, something which Uribe disliked. And Uribe then began an opposition movement against his own protege, Juan Manuel Santos, started his own political party, and in 2018, put one of his new protégés, Iván Duque, as president of Colombia.
Right.
And after that, one of his principal opponents when he was president of Colombia, Gustavo Petro, is now president of the country.
So now under President Petro, as you look across the country, Sergio, what is the legacy of Uribe's tenure as president?
Well, I think there's a mixed legacy, because although Uribe is hugely responsible for a lot of the democratic declines and erosion of some of the checks and balances over the presidency, He also is responsible for largely defeating a huge portion of the FARC group, allowing people for the first time in many, many years to travel outside some of the main cities of the country, wage war frontally against narco trafficking organization and terrorist groups in Colombia. So I do think whichever side you stand on, there's a lot of virtues or there's a lot of warts that you look in Uribe's legacy and you focus on those.
Describe the scene outside the courthouse. I know Uribe had supporters there and they were pretty obvious.
They were saying that this trial was a kangaroo court, that the judges were being biased against the former president, that this was an unfair trial and that the proceedings were a mockery. At the other side of the city, in other neighborhoods, opponents of Uribe were celebrating. They were rejoicing, they were having parties, and they were saying all of Uribe's legacy is now up for debate. He is a criminal. But the truth of the matter is neither his opponents or his supporters are right. His trial is only about whether or not Uribe and his defense tampered with witness testimony and offered them bribes to change their testimony.
So apparently Uribe and his legal team are going to appeal. Is he going to serve time?
It's unclear. The judge hasn't yet ruled. It's very likely that he will be under house arrest during his appeal. And his appeal has to be resolved sometimes before October 8th.
So parliamentary elections are coming up next March in Colombia. What kind of impact do you think this trial and the Uribe guilty verdict will have on the country and the results of the election?
Initially, the Democratic Center does not yet have a mechanism to elect their candidate. And there's around 18 hopefuls on the right wing of the spectrum. So although Uribe will have a huge influence in determining who the candidate for the Democratic Center is, and even so, there's still almost 10 months to go for the presidential election in Colombia. There's still a lot of things that can happen, and this behooves people to continue paying attention to this issue.
Sergio Guzman speaking with us from Bogota, where he is the director of Colombia Risk Analysis.
People who live near the border between Thailand and Cambodia started going home today. That's after less than a week of fighting prompted civilian evacuations from villages. About a quarter million people were displaced in just a matter of days. Thailand and Cambodia reached a ceasefire agreement on Monday. As the World's Matthew Bell reports, it is only a first step.
This has been the worst border clash between Thailand and Cambodia in more than a decade. People on both sides expressed relief today about a possible truce. Sitting on the floor of a crowded evacuation center, Thai evacuee Usra Dasri told Deutsche Welle that this ceasefire is great news.
We normal people who had to leave home would all be happy to be able to go back home. We miss our home. I also think about our soldiers at the front line. I want them to be safe and have a good sleep like us.
Across the border in Cambodia, sitting under a tarp in the heavy rain, evacuee Chuot Nav says she's feeling much the same.
I'm really happy with the ceasefire. I'm happy because I can go home and take care of my pig, dog, chickens, and my kids can now go back to their school.
On Monday, the prime ministers of Thailand and Cambodia met face-to-face and agreed to an unconditional ceasefire. That meeting was hosted by Malaysia's prime minister, Anwar Ibrahim.
This is a vital first step towards a de-escalation and the restoration of peace and security.
Both sides have accused each other of being the real aggressor. There were also reports of violations along the border after the truce was supposed to take effect at midnight last night. But military commanders from Thailand and Cambodia have met several times in recent days, and they announced today that they support the ceasefire. They also said they won't deploy more troops along the border. That's an important development, says Phil Robertson, but it's not clear just how durable this ceasefire will be. He's the director of Asia Human Rights and Labor Advocates based in Bangkok.
Without sending more troops in, without escalating the mobilization, eventually we will sort of begrudgingly on both sides get to a real ceasefire.
In the meantime, however, Robertson reckons there are likely to be more violations along the border.
People, I think, are still quite angry There's a lot of raw sentiment on both sides. The nationalism is really running high. Social media, the memes are flying like crazy. The sentiment from people on both sides, firmly supporting their side and claiming the other side is doing everything wrong and violating every law and principle.
Robertson says the U.S. deserves some credit for getting Thailand and Cambodia to agree on a truce. President Trump got on the phone with the leaders of both countries over the weekend, and he suggested that they would both face big tariffs if they continued to escalate the fighting. Phil Robertson says Thailand and Cambodia also came under pressure from China and from their Southeast Asian neighbors to say yes to a ceasefire.
I was surprised when President Trump actually got involved with this, but I think what they saw was the potential for an easy win and the ability to sort of make an announcement that they had done something important.
But Robertson says he's less optimistic about the administration's willingness to stay engaged on the core issues. One of them goes back decades to the early 20th century, when then-colonial power, France, drew a dividing line between these two countries that neither one has come to fully recognize. Thailand and Cambodia have conflicting claims over small areas along the border, some of which include holy sites revered by people on either side. Malaysia is expected to host another round of talks early next week. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
A cyber attack this week in Russia has authorities there scrambling to recover. Dozens of flights out of Moscow's main airport were canceled or delayed yesterday after a team of pro-Ukrainian hackers shut down the country's biggest airline, Aeroflot. Today, flights have largely resumed with just a few cancellations. But as the world's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel reports, some of the damage might be hard to undo.
Video from inside Sheremetyevo Airport show absolute chaos. Hundreds of passengers stranded, standing shoulder to shoulder outside of gates, luggage in hand, trying to figure out what's going on. Other travelers, resigned to the situation, solemnly lay along the stairs of escalators that were apparently shut down amid the confusion. Many of them took to social media, angrily posting complaints to the airline about a lack of information. According to Dan Diesner with Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, that's probably exactly what the hackers wanted.
The people in Russia, if they feel this, you know, personally, they'll understand that they're at war. And so there's a lot of things going on here besides just, you know, trying to take out the infrastructure. They're trying to, you know, get people to feel it personally.
Diesner says the two groups that have claimed responsibility for the attack, Silent Crow in Ukraine and a Belarusian hacker group called Cyber Partisans, likely targeted the airline during the peak summer travel period for that reason. And they chose to hit the airline's IT system because it's low-hanging fruit from a security standpoint. You don't need to hack into an airplane or air traffic control. You just need to shut down the programs used to schedule flights, tell crews where to go, and what to do with baggage, effectively bringing everything to a halt.
They're attacking, you know, your airline back office systems, you know, and you can't fly airplanes if you can't get people to them, you can't get luggage to them, and you can't get tickets out and those sorts of things.
This is showing the chinks in the armor.
Cybersecurity expert Arun Vishwanath says the success of the attack could indicate that Russia is struggling to keep its infrastructure secure because the war in Ukraine is vacuuming up all the country's resources.
This is an erosion of their capability to withstand a long-term conflict, right? What do all these attacks do? They erode trust that people have in the transit system, in the transport system, in the system and how prepared the infrastructure is.
As of today, the airline systems do appear to mostly be back online, but the effects of the attack could go beyond just travel disruptions. The pro-Ukrainian hackers claiming responsibility also say they gained access to and deleted a ton of data, including phone calls, surveillance information, and flight schedules. Tufts University cybersecurity professor Josephine Wolf says what happens to that data is what she'll be watching for in the days ahead.
Is there also going to be some kind of public shaming element of this in which emails or phone calls or, you know, salaries or other types of data is being released publicly?
According to Russian state news, Aeroflot's client and employee data was not compromised. The Kremlin's prosecutor's office says it's launching a criminal investigation into the incident. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. The Fukushima nuclear power plant was destroyed by an earthquake and tsunami back in 2011 in Japan. Today, we hear from the plant's operator that another 12 to 15 years of prep work is needed before they can even start removing debris from reactor number 3. That's how long it will take to sufficiently reduce radiation levels.
This is just the latest in a series of setbacks, but the plant operator says the goal is still to decommission Fukushima by 2051. We are aware of the difficulty, said one official, but we will not drop the goal just yet.
Very difficult. Some experts say decommissioning could take more than a century. Meanwhile, far from Fukushima, in Aspen, Colorado, a Japanese wellness practice helping Westerners immerse themselves in nature. So pretty much the opposite of radioactive debris that can't be touched. I'm talking about a Japanese Shinto practice that's gained popularity in recent years. Reporter Heidi Shin went into the woods for our story.
We're in Aspen, Colorado, surrounded by snow-capped mountains and tall white trees.
Part of the story of this tree is the bear claws on it. Do you see that? Yeah, a bear climbed up there.
Melanie Chukas-Bradley is a naturalist from Washington, D.C., where she leads forest bathing walks for places like the Smithsonian and the U.S. Botanical Garden. But today, she's at the Aspen Ideas Festival with a group of global leaders. There are former heads of state here, lots of CEOs, innovators, and leaders of nonprofits.
My name is Gabriela Santos. I'm from El Salvador. I work on human rights back in El Salvador.
My name is Bree. I moved to Baltimore. I'm a fellow to start my organization that's working on the hyper-vacancy crisis in Baltimore, where there's 15,000 vacant buildings.
They're trying to fix broken systems, which are technically and politically challenging. Things like democracy, the rapid evolution of AI, the country's polarized views around immigration, global vaccines, and climate change. But before their morning roundtables and talks, 24 of them have decided to come on a forest bathing walk at the Aspen Institute's campus, led by Chukas-Bradley.
I'm going to invite you to walk in silence. Leave a little space between you and the person in front of you. Notice what's in motion.
Forest bathing, contrary to its name, doesn't involve any bathing. Rather, it's a kind of deliberate, meditative walk through nature. Its roots date back to ancient Japanese Shinto and Buddhist beliefs that there are spirits called kami, which inhabit natural elements like trees, rocks, and waterfalls. But the term forest bathing, or shirin-yoku, was actually coined much more recently, in 1982 by the Japanese government, in response to a rapidly industrializing country.
They wanted to encourage people to go out into the forests. They call the sounds in nature pink noise, the soothing sounds of nature.
In other words, it was a government initiative to help stressed-out salarymen in Tokyo.
There's even a Japanese phrase, death by work.
And the benefits were twofold. It helped with people's health, and it helped preserve the environment. The more time people spent in the forests, the more they cared about the trees.
It became really popular, and now in Japan, there are more than 60 forests that are dedicated to forest bathing.
Chukas-Bradley recently trained there as a forest bathing guide.
They check your salivary amylase, which can indicate if you're under stress, and then you go on your walk and you come back and they check it again. And lo and behold, your blood pressure has gone down.
As you enter the healing forest in Japan, there's a station where the staff checks your vitals, your pulse, your blood pressure. But as much as forests can be a place for healing and refocus, they can also be a reminder of grief. In Colorado, there are swaths of forests blackened by recurring wildfires brought about by climate change. And forests can be a place that people seek out when they're grieving. Chukas-Bradley tells us about the walk she takes in Washington, D.C.
I go on nature walks with Congressman Jamie Raskin.
In January 2021, Congressman Raskin had just lost his son to suicide. The same week, rioters took violently to the Capitol building.
I think for people who do such important, complicated, difficult work, spending time in nature is very therapeutic. His connection with nature in Rock Creek Park has been, it's just been a salvation for him.
Chukwis Bradley says that nature's also often a space for people who've grown up religious, but have found that their beliefs have changed, and they're still seeking some kind of spiritual connection.
You know, some people are kind of recovering from some pretty strict or severe religious backgrounds. And this is a very gentle way to open yourself up to the, you know, the mysteries of the unknown.
It's also a place for young people, Gen Z, who are making meaning of a complex world. We approach the Roaring Fork River from a distance. The running water is quiet until Chukwis Bradley instructs us to cup our ears with our backs to the water.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
And you can do that anywhere. I mean, even if you're in the city and there's a fountain.
And Chukwis Bradley says that you don't need a forest to forest bathe. Adopting a favorite neighborhood tree or even a desktop plant can help. But note, it's not the same as a muddy runner or triathlon training. To feel the benefits of Shirin-Yoku, it should be a slow and intentional walk. And while it started in Japan, the practice is spreading globally. Jennifer Lemire is on one of Chukwis Bradley's walks this week. She works for Partners in Health, a global health organization, which brings medical care to places like Haiti, West Africa, and the Ukraine. And the White House cuts to U.S. aid have not been easy.
Probably my first reaction was anger and despair, and then just sort of a disbelief that it was all happening, unfolding so fast and seemingly so callously.
The walk has given her a much-needed break and perspective, as well as a shared experience. She tells me about a young public health student she met earlier who had questions about entering the field.
You know, we had this very real conversation about the challenges. What is global health 3.0 going to look like? But she gets to be the generation that rebuilds what's next. All of my interactions with the younger generation leave me with a lot of hope that there's something better coming.
At the end of the walk, we arrive at a stone sculpture where we lay on our backs on the slab and take in the sunny Colorado morning. Chukwis Bradley asks for a volunteer.
Do any of you enjoy reading poetry aloud? Oh, good.
Here's an excerpt read by Angelica Jackson. She's the founder of the Phoenix International School of the Arts.
The Peace of Wild Things by Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lay down where the wood drake rests and the great heron feeds. And I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free.
Afterwards, the forest bathers get back to work. Wearing suits and blazers, they're back to solving some of the world's most pressing problems together. For The World, I'm Heidi Shin, Aspen, Colorado.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Spanish government came to power promising to root out corruption. Now those same leaders are facing charges of, you guessed it, corruption. Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez is in hot water over a scandal involving kickbacks for public works projects. From Barcelona, The World's Jerry Haddon reports that faith in the system is waning.
Back in 2018, when Pedro Sanchez was opposition leader, he delivered the most decisive speech of his career, blasting conservative Popular Party Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy for corruption at the highest levels of his government. Sanchez demanded a no-confidence vote in Congress.
Esta moción de censura, señorías, es consecuencia de hechos gravísimos.
Today's vote, Sanchez said, is the result of terrible things, scandals that have embarrassed our people, leaving them incredulous and angry. Those scandals involved hundreds of Popular Party officials allegedly taking bribes from contractors. Sanchez's no-confidence vote passed, and he won snap elections. But that day in Congress, it's come back to haunt him.
Usted, señor presidente, ha hundido hasta límites insospechados.
This is José Luis Ábalos, another socialist congressman. He also went after Rajoy in the chamber that day. Your actions, Ábalos scolded, have sunk your office to unimaginable lows. unimaginable until perhaps Ábalos himself. He went on to become transportation minister in Sánchez's new government and allegedly Spain's next corruption kingpin. A judge has now accused him of the same thing that brought Rajoy down, taking kickbacks from contractors. Also involved, Sánchez's right-hand man in the Socialist Party, Carlos Cerdán. Cerdán was jailed this month pending trial.
Señor Sánchez, los españoles quieren salvarse de usted.
Predictably, the opposition has seized upon this scandal in the hopes of a comeback. Today's popular party leader, Albert Núñez Feijóo, told Sánchez in Congress that the Spanish people long for rescuing. He called on Sánchez to resign. So far, Sánchez has refused.
El capitán no se desentiende cuando viene mala mar. Se queda a capear el temporal, a salvar el río.
In a storm, he said recently, a captain doesn't abandon the ship. Corruption, you might say, is the ping-pong of Spanish politics, with fast-moving scandals bouncing back and forth and back again. In fact, they've been haunting Spain since it became a democracy in 1978. Spanish journalist Maria Ramirez says when Spain emerged from dictatorship, it managed to set up three independent branches of government, but neither of the two main political parties has ever created solid ways to safeguard against corruption.
Maybe because they could benefit from a kind of lax system when they get back to power. We clearly need more systemic changes, no matter who is in government.
Ramirez says the penalties for companies caught paying kickbacks to politicians are just slaps on the wrist. The result? They can keep doing it without much risk to their bottom lines. The resulting scandals, she says, have eroded the public's confidence in elected leaders.
Also, the low confidence in politics is really dangerous and helps populism, extreme parties. For now, we haven't seen those parties getting so much power. But if the two mainstream parties keep disappointing people, we could see a very different national government going forward.
The disappointments do keep on coming.
El caso Montoro ha estallado. Detrás está el todopoderoso ministro de
Hacienda del PP. The latest hit the popular party just last week. Its former finance minister, Cristóbal Montoro, is accused of taking tens of millions of dollars in bribes from energy companies, then letting them modify draft laws to their benefit. As journalist Ramirez points out, the corruption fuels Spain's extremist parties, especially Vox on the far right. There's so much corruption on the center-left and right, said Vox President Santiago Abascal this week. It's almost becoming boring. Polls suggest Vox is set to become Spain's third most voted political party. If elections were held tomorrow, it'd get around 15% of the vote and gain 11 more seats in Congress. For Prime Minister Sánchez, that's not boring, it's dangerous. He says he's trying to make things right, restore a little faith in the system by tackling corruption once and for all. He's pledged to create an independent anti-corruption agency to oversee government and to set up special courts that can dish out longer prison sentences for corruption.
Un sistema de exclusión y de listas negras para impedir que las empresas condenadas.
And will create a blacklist of companies found guilty of paying bribes, Sánchez told Congress. Those companies, he said, would be banned from competing for public contracts. But most of Sánchez's ideas are not new. The European Union and some Spanish NGOs have proposed these things for years. What would be new? A Spanish government actually following through on them. For The World, I'm Cherry Haddon, Barcelona.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
Sierra is one of the first public figures to take advantage of a new citizenship law in the West African nation of Benin. The U.S. pop singer had a citizenship ceremony over the weekend. Benin is trying to attract members of the black diaspora while acknowledging the country's role in the transatlantic slave trade. Benin is healing a historic wound, said the country's justice minister.
A boat chase in the Caribbean lasted more than 12 hours today as Dominican authorities used helicopters and boats to track down a vessel carrying 1.5 tons of cocaine. They eventually apprehended it in what is considered one of the Dominican Republic's biggest drug seizures ever.
And in Germany, public protests did not stop a zoo from killing 12 baboons today. Officials at the Tiergarten Nuremberg Zoo said it had too little space to properly house the animals and couldn't find another zoo to take them. Animal rights groups say the killings violated animal protection laws.
And that is a few things you might have missed. Brazil is the world's biggest consumer and importer of shark meat. There's new reporting that shows the Brazilian government itself is a major player in this market. The government buys massive quantities of shark that then get served in public institutions across the country. That is a problem because shark contains high levels of mercury, a neurotoxin, and people don't always know they're eating shark. Carla Mendez is an investigative reporter who's been looking into the issue. She contributed to a report published today in the environmental news outlet Manga Bay. Carla joined us from Rio de Janeiro.
Sharks are predators. So there is a process called bioaccumulation. So heavy metals like mercury, they are present in predators, and it happens because not only the mercury that's in the animal, but also from other animals that it eats, because it's at the top of the chain, so it just get it all.
So why is the government buying all the shark meat if it's contaminated with mercury and then passing it on to the general population?
Going back a little bit, fishermen, usually they target sharks because of the fins, because it's a delicacy for Asian markets. So they export
right,
it
soup.
For,
right.
Yes. But then what to do with the body of the shark? And so there was a legislation in Brazil prohibiting the boats to arrive in the port only with the fins. If you're selling fins, you must bring the body as well. So indirectly, that legislation ended up fueling the market of shark meat. And so they start selling that meat locally. On the other side, nutritionists are the one in charge of putting together the menus of these meals for public tenders. And for kids and elder people, they are highly concerned about the presence of bones in fish. And shark meat doesn't have bones because it has a completely different structure. So from several institutions we heard and nutritionists, that's the main thing.
And I understand that the dishes containing shark meat often in Brazil use a term for it that people don't always understand. So Brazilians don't always know they're eating shark meat. What is it typically called there?
Yeah, here they call it cação.
And why would that be confusing?
Because people, they think it's a specific type of fish. Most of people don't know that cação is shark, and including nutritionists I interviewed.
Is that part of the controversy in Brazil, that people are eating something they don't know is shark?
It is, because like we looked at several shark meat being sold at the grocery store. No one of them says it's shark. They only says it's cação. And I even interviewed, you know, officials in Brasilia, including from the federal department in charge of consumer rights. The official didn't know that cação was shark until the moment I interviewed him. So like you see, that's not something that, oh, just people with low level of education don't know. It's something that's widespread. I spoke with my friends that are from several professions, you know, have master's degree and all that. And most of them didn't know.
Much of your reporting takes place around public schools just outside Rio de Janeiro. You've spoken with parents and educators who are campaigning to get shark removed from school menus. What have they been telling you?
I interviewed several sources at Duque de Caxias, that's a city in the outskirts of Rio de Janeiro. And there is an instructor, Solange Bergami. She has been battling for a long time to remove cação from shark meat from the school meals. But not because she knew it was cação. Initially, she noted that the students were rejecting that fish because it smells badly and, you know, they didn't like the taste. And then she was highly concerned because the most of the students there come from poor classes, and sometimes it's their only source of protein in the entire day. And so if they're throwing away shark meat, they are not having any protein that day. This year, some months ago, the city hall of Duque de Caxias acquired some other type of fish, hake fish, but they said they couldn't really replace cação because they found fish bones on it. So cação is still being served once a week, every other week, in all schools in Duque de Caxias.
So, Carla, what's next with shark meat in Brazil? Do you get the sense that things could change, or does it look like shark meat is here to stay?
I'm really hopeful that this investigation could drive changes in public policy, because what we see is really a lack of information, lack of transparency. There is a bill that was proposed to ban shark meat purchases for tenders for the federal government. But the problem is that Brazilian National Congress is the most conservative ever in decades. So we see a huge influence of agribusiness and people with other interests that are against environmental policy. And like the project is stuck there.
That's Carla Mendes, an investigative reporter in Rio de Janeiro.
As sea levels rise, the government in the Netherlands is racing to adapt. It's a famously low-lying country. Rotterdam, in particular, sits a full 20 feet below sea level in places. But one dairy farm has come up with a clever way to keep its cows afloat. The World's Joshua Coe checked it out as part of our series, The Big Fix, all about innovative ways communities are dealing with climate change.
Right now, we are walking through a dairy farm in the middle of Rotterdam. Rotterdam is one of the largest ports in Europe. In fact, it's the largest. But what might not seem totally obvious here is the fact that this dairy farm is actually floating, and it's floating right in the middle of the harbor. Appropriately, it's named Floating Farm. Parked dockside in an underused part of Rotterdam's harbor, 32 cows live on the top floor of this three-story pontoon barge. And co-founder Minka van Wiengarden says it's probably the world's first seaborne dairy farm.
So we produce milk, we produce yogurt, buttermilk, butter, but also cheese. And downstairs in the basement, we produce vegetables. We have just started our vertical farm, so at this moment we have started with microgreens.
Set up in 2019 by Van Wiengarden and her husband, the goal has been to localize food production and in a climate-adaptive way. She says they were inspired by a major storm that hit the U.S. East Coast, Hurricane Sandy, back in 2012.
And we, at that time, were involved in a floating housing project. And at that moment, we saw that already when Manhattan was flooded, after 2 days, there was no fresh food on the shelves in the shops.
There's not the same risk of a hurricane here, she says, but there's always concerns about flooding. And in the event of a storm surge, the farm is something like Noah's Ark, but for dairy products.
We go up and down with the tide, so we always can keep on producing fresh, healthy food. And we create more or less arable land in the city.
The Dutch have long been innovators in the realm of keeping the water out. 90% of Rotterdam sits below sea level. Dikes, water pumps, and massive storm surge barriers all work in concert to keep the city dry. But climate change is raising the risks of flooding. Van Wiengarden says that with more storm surges and more sea level rise, people also need to start thinking more about how to go with the flow. While the output of the farm is relatively small, limited to around 200 gallons of milk per day, their milk and cheese get distributed locally to stores around Rotterdam, including Spar, a major European supermarket chain. In exchange, the stores help feed the cows, with what's otherwise going to be thrown away.
When we go to the supermarkets, we bring our dairy and we take back the orange peels from the fresh orange juice and it goes to the cows, and it really makes the feed very fresh.
While Floating Farm is all about climate resilience and reducing waste, I can't help but see one glaring issue. In terms of climate change, cows are well-known contributors. Between flatulence and belching, cows emit a lot of methane. It's a major greenhouse gas warming the planet. That noise you hear in the background, that's a giant robot vacuum cleaner, kind of like a poop Roomba. It moves around the room, picking up another cow product, cow pies.
It soaks up the poo, the manure from the cows, and it brings the poo to one corner. There it falls down in the manure separator. We separate it immediately, and doing this, we have 60% less emission.
While Van Wiengarden grew up in the Dutch countryside, neither she nor her husband had ever farmed before. And she says that if they could do it all over again, they wouldn't have chosen to start with cows.
And we have learned a lot. We learn every day. I compare it when you build your first own house. Already the first day, you realize how stupid I have been. So it's about learning and doing. When I look backwards, it's the most difficult thing we could have started with. I realize that.
Now, why is that? What makes it so difficult?
Because it are big animals on the water, so we have some logistic challenges. And also, when you have livestock, yeah, it's more intense than veggies, for instance.
32 cows that are on a floating platform in the middle of the city. I mean, how do you ensure that the cows are happy? Do they get seasick?
Oh, that's a very good topic. And actually, to get the permits for this, we needed to prove that the cows would not get seasick.
University researchers helped them show that the cows are no more sick being on the barge than being on trucks that transport them from inland farms. They did catch some local media attention a few years back when a cow fell off the gangplank that leads to the onshore pasture where they graze. Von Wiengarten says that was another lesson learned. And don't worry, cows can swim. For The World, I'm Joshua Coe, Rotterdam.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Sudan's civil war has been raging for more than 2 years and is one of the world's most brutal conflicts. More than 150,000 people have died, civilians face indiscriminate attack, and famine has been declared in parts of Sudan's western Darfur region. The Sudanese government forces are battling the paramilitary rapid support forces. And this week, the RSF and its allies say they formed a parallel government. Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He joins me now to explain. Cameron, the rapid support forces are establishing a parallel government. What does this do for them?
Well, I think what they hope it does is establish some degree of credibility for them to join in what they hope will be eventual peace talks, possibly mediated by the United States, but essentially attempting to put themselves on par with the military-backed government that was announced about a month ago. So really trying to sort of level the playing field, make themselves appear more legitimate and, you know, more respectable in the eyes of the international community, quite frankly.
And remind us why that is needed, where the RSF originated.
Well, the RSF grew out of what was then called the Janjaweed, which was a government-formed militia group during the genocide in Darfur 20 years ago, which carried out the government's kind of scorched earth policies on the ground, setting fire to Darfuri villages, ethnically cleansing much of the region, killing, raping, looting. The International Criminal Court, has said that genocide occurred in Darfur, and many of the leaders of the Janjaweed were sanctioned both by the United Nations and by the United States. So in the years after the worst of the violence, the Bashir regime essentially normalized the Janjaweed, bringing them under the broad security umbrella of the state, giving them uniforms and turning them into this rapid support forces group, which is subsequently broken away from the security forces of the country and are now essentially fighting the army for control of Sudan.
You mentioned potential future peace talks. A lot of regional powers are in Washington this week to talk about Sudan, but neither the Sudanese armed forces nor the rapid support forces are there. Why aren't they at the table?
Well, I think this is a preliminary conversation that the Trump administration has organized, recognizing that much of the violence that is going on in Darfur and in Sudan right now and over the past 3 years of this conflict has been driven and promoted by outside actors, all of whom have competing interests in the outcome of this war. And so by bringing the principal backers of this conflict, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Egypt to the table, I think the Trump Trump administration is acknowledging that it has a special relationship with those countries, that it has some influence and leverage over them. And I think what it's trying to do in a first step is to establish what are everyone's interests in Sudan, what are they hoping to achieve, and are there any kind of points of commonality that we can begin to build upon if we want to try to apply pressure on the parties to end the conflict and to refrain, have those parties refrain from continuing to support the parties to the conflict.
Eventually, though, the Rapid Support Forces and the Sudanese Armed Forces would have to sit down and be part of any peace deal that is decided for it to work, right?
Presumably, yes. I mean, they are the belligerents on the ground. They control the humanitarian access. They control the tempo of war. They are responsible principally for the atrocities that have been committed in this conflict. Even though they have been supported and enabled by outside actors, they are ultimately responsible for the conduct of this war. And they will ultimately have to be responsible for whatever peace is agreed to. And so they will have to be brought into this conversation at some point. They have not demonstrated much of an interest in being a part of a peace process at this point. They are still, I think, jockeying for position on the battlefield, trying to gain an upper hand, which neither of them seem quite able to do right now. That's why I think the Trump administration has started with bringing in outside actors, trying to create consensus and then build pressure on the parties to relent.
There hasn't been much progress on the peace front in this conflict. Where would you say that diplomatic efforts to end the war stand right now?
Yeah, not very advanced at this stage. The British held a conference this past spring, I think really trying to shed light and draw attention to the level of atrocities that are going on and the level of humanitarian suffering. There has been more focus, I think, on that, on how can we get aid in, how can we save lives and avoid famine, which is looming over many parts of Sudan right now. In addition, how do we allow refugees to return to their homes in areas where there isn't fighting going on. So the focus has of the diplomacy has really been much more on the humanitarian as opposed to trying to find a political solution. So it's going to be a very difficult process to find that political solution. And I think the Trump administration is actually starting at the right place, which is trying to choke off the outside support to these parties, bring leverage and pressure upon them to stop the fighting. But we have to remember that, you know, we've been down this road before in Sudan. There has been genocide and civil war in Sudan going back to Sudan's founding in 1956. So unless the Trump administration and outside actors are serious about beginning to address really the root causes of the conflict, not just this conflict, but all of the previous conflicts that Sudan has suffered through, I think we are probably looking at kind of tactical maneuvers to try to end the fighting and end the suffering, but probably not a lot of long-term solutions that are going to put Sudan on a much more sustainable path to peace in the long run.
Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's been speaking with us about Sudan's civil war. Cameron, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Earlier this hour, we looked at the cyber attack on Aeroflot and the hacking incident that's tied up air travel across Russia. There is a different kind of cybercrime that's been targeting hospitals, ransom attacks that lock facilities out of their own computer systems until they pay up. Join us tomorrow on the show when we'll look at why hospitals in the UK have been victims of cyber attacks and what they can do about it.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Steve Henn, Dan Shee and Ted McGovern, Sharon G. and Robert Ryan, and Frederica and Howard Stevenson. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.